Hello and welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Scott Hoag, and today with me is my co-host Tom Coffeen. Ed Horley's out today at Tech Field Day, but today our guest is Denise Fishburne with Cisco. Her good friends call her Fish, and frankly, everyone is her friend. What we love about Fish is her ability to dig deeply into the most technical subjects, teach it to us so we understand, give us good deployment advice, and when it comes time to troubleshoot, she helps us learn how to fish. A few things that she may be too modest to tell you about herself. She's a double CCIE, CCDE, 2639 is her CCIE number, CCDE 2009:14. I love that CCDE numbers are look like IPv6.
Yeah, do you like that? Yeah, that was intentional. Yeah, that was actually intentional from the creators of the CCDE program. It's awesome.
Denise hails from RTP, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, for those maybe not familiar with U.S. geography. For years, she's worked in the Cisco Customer Proof of Concept Labs, or CPOC for short, where she gets to work with the coolest tools. Now she's a solution architect at Cisco, sharing with us all kinds of cool stuff and sharing with the community. So you just got back from Cisco Live Europe in Barcelona a couple weeks ago.
In Barcelona, actually, I was just teaching the tech RST 1310. We don't typically do troubleshooting multicast over there. And so I was doing the BGP technical seminar, and I also got invited to join the panel as somebody newer to DevNet so they could have different views on using open software approach to network automation. And while I was there, I was also doing a lot of stealth watch and also meeting up with, admittedly, some of my IPv6 friends.
Well, Denise, you've spent a lot of time in your career, you know, really getting familiar with IPv6 and really learning how to troubleshoot it effectively. You know, what inspired you to do that originally? What was the decision point where you thought that it was a technology that you really wanted to focus on and get an expert level of understanding with?
So actually, it was back in 2001 when, so I felt like I was kind of late to the game. It was back in 2001 when the manager of CPOC said, we're starting to get IPv6, you know, more IPv6 requests sent. And we didn't have a subject matter expert in it at the time. So he asked who would like to take it on. I said I would. Back then, the CPOCs, the proof of concepts that we were doing, the custom proof of concepts that we were doing, the customers weren't at the time heavily getting into IPv6. What they were really doing was making sure they were just kind of sort of doing checklist IPv6. They were making sure that the boxes that they were going to buy would support IPv6. So it was like, you know, bring up IPv6 BGP, make sure the prefixes work, bring up OSPF, make sure the prefixes work. I really love IPv6, and I have to admit, from my perspective, that I find it very frustrating. So many networking, I mean, I'll talk to people when they come through CPOC, and I'll ask them, just out of curiosity, you know, what's your deployment level? I think that it really frustrates me sometimes, like when enterprise customers don't think it's getting deployed, and I'm like, have you looked at all the places that it's getting deployed? And so it's frustrating to me. It's very frustrating to me because it's inevitable. And I just don't understand why some companies are not moving over.
One of the things I respect about you, Denise, is that you're not afraid to open up the protocol analyzer. That's something we do more often. And we talked about this on our show with Jeff Carroll, who knows a lot about Wireshark, is you're often looking for an IPv6 needle in a haystack of IPv4. Mm-hmm. So you have to be good at the protocol analyzer. And maybe many network engineers maybe don't use a protocol analyzer as much on their legacy V4 networks. And so one of my favorite things that you wrote, speaking of favorite things, is your 7-part blog series you wrote about understanding IPv6. And what I like about it is it's like a forensic murder mystery. It's like, who done it? And I love that. And I know you do a lot with the like network detective theme. So tell us how that started and what precipitated that blog.
So what started with the IPv6 blog is I wanted to write something that would have helped me back in 2001 to make the transition. And I'm very visual. I am very dependent on being able to see a flow. My favorite GUI actually is Wireshark. It's actually my favorite graphical user interface. I kid that I'm a CLI girl living in a GUI world. My favorite GUI is Wireshark and has been since I was at IBM. I wanted to write a series that would have helped me looking back in understanding IPv6. So I wanted to write the series that wasn't there in 2001 for me. So I wrote it as if I was speaking to myself in 2001. And because I will admit that when I was new to it, I was mentioning that, you know, I was just doing routing. It's embarrassing to say that, like, I could get IPv6 going, you know, just bring up the BGP IPv6 peer, you know, follow some configs and boom, you know, you have prefixes going. But I didn't know about link local. I didn't know so many things. And even though I was configuring it in 2001 in the lab, BGP peers and all this stuff, I didn't realize it didn't have a broadcast address. And so that was humbling because I thought I was this, you know, IPv6, like, you know, kick butt person in CPOC because I was the only one who knew it back in 2001. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it doesn't have broadcasted. And then I just went back to square one. And when I went back to square one, I looked at the snipper trace, I reverse engineered, and something occurred to me. Why do you ARP? Right? So something occurred to me, a way of teaching other people. Because for me, when I was new to IPv6, there was a lot of new terms. And I really have a hard time when there's a lot of new terms. Neighbor discovery, solicited node, blah, 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 you know, Slack. And then there's two different versions. And, you know, so those were all abstract concepts. And I'm not good at memorization. I'm better at watching the flow. So I wasn't as great in biology class in high school. I was better with physics and calculus and things that once I could see the flow or the equation or the calculation, then I was good at it. So what I realized was the purposes and the reasons for the solicited node multicast. And I was scared when I saw a whole bunch of threes in the snipper trace. And I wanted to demystify all of that for other people. And then I went to CHINOG, Chicago Network Operators Group, to teach it verbally to them. And the bottom line is, I just need your destination MAC address. By sending an address resolution protocol and IPv4, I'm asking everybody, okay? But ultimately, I just want to get to you. So all I need to know is an IPv4, I know you're listening to the broadcast. So I know that I can get to your ears. I can get to you. Mm-hmm. I just need to know how to do that in IPv6. So I think that that series, except for the first part one, parts two through seven, were actually the blogs that have taken me the most time to write and also the blogs that I'm most proud of.
Yeah, I think that's what some people struggle with IPv6 is when they see that a link local address could be a next hop address for a route. They're like, how can that happen? I'm like, well, mm-hmm. it just needs to take that link local, find its MAC address, and then build an Ethernet frame to take that VC mm-hmm. and send it along towards the destination. Just get it one hop closer to the destination. That's all I care about is just get it onto an Ethernet frame, off to the next hop. But the link local is not the destination. It's just the means to get it one hop further on its way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the neighbor discovery protocol, if you just ask, all I'm doing is I'm just asking you. It's just how I'm asking you, what's your destination MAC address? It's how I'm getting you mm-hmm. to listen to me. And so those things weren't when I got into it in 2001, they weren't very clear, or maybe I didn't know enough to read it.
2001, I mean, you're running a special version of iOS on your 2514 router. You know, you're having to compile IPv6 into the kernel.
We were past
and all the neighbor discovery stuff at that time at the operating system level. I mean, those are the early days. Like, there's been so much iteration on the operating system level. So
yes.
But it's incredibly powerful. And you know, we're speaking very specifically about things like neighbor discovery leading to a next hop of a link local address. But the like pulling the lens back and that moment when you realize it's like, wow, what we've done is we've decoupled layer two from layer three at the link local level.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, besides that, what are some of your other biggest surprises about IPv6 in your journey?
Oh my gosh. Like everybody else in the journey, I think I asked Shannon McFarlane. I think I asked Jim Bailey. I think I asked Tim Martin. Come on, explain to me, why do I have to give you a slash 64? So I think I, like everybody else, and they'd be like, well, but if you didn't do a 64, you couldn't do the Slack thing because it wants, and you know, and I'm like, okay, now I have to understand Slack. But I think the 64 thing really, really was, that was a huge surprise. And it was a huge surprise until I understood and could really tie it back to Slack. So that was a surprise. Biggest surprise, absolutely hands down, biggest surprise is how scared people are by IPv6. That's my biggest surprise.
Yeah, people spend their whole lives learning IPv4. Why wouldn't they want to learn the new version?
I don't understand that. And I tie it back to, and I'll be honest, and I see this all the time. So many people are in IT right now. So many people are being tasked with doing more with less. And so a lot of people are in what is called Stephen Covey's quadrant one of urgent and important, and not in quadrant two, which is important but not urgent. Right. So it's like so many people don't necessarily take care of things. It's like, okay, put gas in the car before you run out of gas. Okay. Cause it's important, but it's not urgent yet. Okay. Now you're about to run out of gas. So now it's urgent and important, but we just seem to, you know, to do these things over and over and over again. Start taking care of it now. You know, RFC 1918 isn't big enough for all the different stuff that we're doing. And come on, IoT? That's my biggest surprise.
Yeah, enterprises please. Seem like they're playing chicken with IPv6. Now, I think if you were in the realm of the early adopters, things are painful. You know, back in 2001, around IPv6, things might have been difficult. Now they're easier. So I guess enterprises think, well, if I put it off, will the amount of effort required to deploy it be less? Maybe there'll be more resources available, or staff will slowly pick up and be trained on it just osmotically because they have to go take their CCNA or CCNP exam, and Cisco, you know, puts that into the exam, so you have to learn it. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't think it necessarily gets tremendously easier the later you wait. But I also think that the later you an enterprise wait, it doesn't make it easy or automatic.
No. I like what Shannon McFarlane said in one of his books. I think I'm going to paraphrase this wrong, but he was basically in phase one, when you start trying to deploy it, you're going to be doing this, and you're going to be, you know, beating up your vendors. And then you're going to go to phase two, you're going to be doing this, and this, you're going to be beating up your vendors. And then you're going to go to, you know, phase three. And it was like every phase he had, you're going to be beating up your vendors. And the people who write the applications, right? Because some of those applications are, you know, it's a fixed 32-bit. And you can't put the 128 in there, stuff like that, because we just didn't, you know, people didn't do things proactively. I think enterprise, other things, service providers, everyone else, they seem to be like way ahead. Enterprise just seems to be like lagging sometimes.
Yeah, and I hate to sound like a curmudgeon about it, but it's like, oh, you think you have it bad now. You mean the late adopter advantage that enterprises have, you know, and you think, well, just what we had to put up with how the operating system behaved or didn't behave, you know, all of the ways in which with Shannon's point about having to beat up the vendors because the vendors are like, oh, yeah, sure, we support it. And then you deploy it and it falls over. But so much of that has been worked out. It's never been easier to deploy IPv6
so easy now.
In the enterprise.
It is so awesomely easier.
Yeah, because it's almost as if it's just turned into, you know, an issue of folding it into whatever network management practice you have.
Yep.
And it's not as if that's a new problem or challenge. I mean, there's always new technologies that have to be folded into whatever your existing network management practice is. IPv6 is just among them. So it is really kind of perplexing. You know, you've got folks that are coming through CPOC. Do you have advice that you give them? Can you point them the right direction? Like, what do you tell them to get them inspired to try to start tackling IPv6?
I've been in CPOC actually since, you know, 2001 when I volunteered. So I've been in CPOC for the past 18 years. What I really find is that even public sector can be ahead of enterprise. Service providers are ahead of enterprise. LATAM is ahead of American enterprises. Europe is ahead of American enterprises. If you look around the world at the IPv6 deployment space outside of the United States, the IPv6 sessions in Cisco Live Europe, you know, when I'm in those sessions and people raise, you know, where is your deployment? They're like, you know, heavily deployed. I have service providers coming in doing major, major, major IPv6 and wanting to test for IPv6 and also VPNv6. They want to test a device that Cisco has for a VPNv6 route reflector. And can it hold a million VPNv6 routes, you know, NLRIs? I find that when I talk to Latin American customers that come through, European, that's what I mostly see. We don't really see too much Asia coming through the United States, but they're so much further along outside the United States. Even a number of universities. Yeah, so a lot of universities that I know of are further along than enterprise, commercial, public sector. And so I do usually ask them, and pretty much what it is RFC 1918, you know, we'll get them through. RFC 1918 will work. So the only people that I see when they come through CPOC that are typically the people that I see that are large enterprises are large global enterprises peering with other regions around the world. And they have been doing IPv6. So I've got some universities that like have like so much IPv6 and they've been doing it since 2003.
They would have a lot of V4 public address space at their disposal.
It's very interesting. There's a lot of universities that I've had come through that are so advanced on the IPv6. It is so cool to see. You know, they get BYOD to a level that hospitals could just laugh at. I mean, the BYOD at universities is just incredible. And the IoT at universities is just incredible. So I'm asking you questions. So that's what I see. You know, who do you see lags behind us, especially in the U.S., for IPv6?
Yeah, commercial enterprises who haven't yet run out of 10-net space, mm-hmm. small, medium businesses that are afraid of deploying provider-assigned address space because they don't have source address, destination, routing, SATR, or other things that might help them. So I'd say those.
You know, you brought up a really good point about IoT. So interestingly enough, I'm very passionate as I've gotten more and more into security about IoT. We're being asked, pressured by upper management to deploy IoT devices into our network at a rate that is faster than we as engineers feel that we can figure out who are they talking to, who do they need to talk to, you know, what are they doing in our network? So that's another thing, because so much IoT is moving towards IPv6 and a lot of things on the manufacturing floor and stuff like that, IPv6. My interesting thing about that is it's like, okay, so not only you're going to be time pressured for IPv4 IoT and existing and knowing what they're talking to now, but what are you going to do? Wait until you start having to deploy IPv6 IoT devices to learn IPv6 and figure out what they're doing?
Yeah, no risk there, right? What could go wrong?
Yeah, so from a security perspective, I mean, we have enough risk for IPv4 IoT and people having to put it in. I love this one story. There was an MRI unit. They looked at it and they thought, oh, it was just an MRI and it just needs to talk to this. And they just went ahead and they deployed it. And they put it in. First person got in. It couldn't get it connected to the music because what they didn't realize was that the MRI was actually getting its music up from the internet. And that's just a protocol that people were already thinking that they knew who it was supposed to talk to and how it talks.
Yeah.
So I don't understand that. I just don't, because then you're going to be putting IoT devices into your network and enabling and learning IPv6 at the same time. Yeah.
If the MRI machine can't talk to the internet, then it uses the default Cisco Unity hold message, like the bionic man, like.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny. That's actually a fun song. I mean, it's like I've gotten so used to that song. It's like I feel comfortable with that song. It's
if you I gotta MRI machine, you'd be okay with that.
I gotta tell you this. So my sister, who's older than me, my mother was majorly clean. She loves to clean things, and she likes to have everything around her clean. So my sister, who's 2 years older, when she was first born, so a complete newborn, just brought it home. My mom wanted to make sure she got used to the vacuum cleaner noise and wasn't afraid of it. So she would overly vacuum like around her, like vacuum all the time. And what was so funny was my sister, when she was like in her 30s one time, was talking about, you know, having to have roommates in a house that she bought. And it was really strange because when they vacuum, you know, they'll be like, oh, you know, is the vacuuming going to disturb you, you know, when you're trying to take a nap? And she's like, no, I love it for some reason. So my mom just started cracking up. So yeah, that's what the Cisco hold music has happened to us. It's like, oh, I can fall asleep now. You don't like the whole music?
I think it's fine. I've gotten used to it like you.
Yeah, me too.
Like all of us. Yeah, tell us a little bit about some of the new things you're doing with regards to security. And
about a year and a half ago, our group reorged. So CPOC kind of sort of joined a few other groups. One of them actually is a group called DCloud. Another one is the Experience Briefing Centers, Customer Briefing Centers. I asked if I could kind of sort of get into security. I found myself leaning towards this thing called StealthWatch. It was a product by a company called Landcope. We bought them a few years ago. And basically, I think the reason why I like it so much, I told you one of my weaknesses is end hosts. So that's why I had so much fun in reading Ed's book about, you know, Microsoft and end hosts and stuff like that. I have been playing a lot with StealthWatch, which has been really probably the best avenue that I could get into for learning what kind of exploits end devices do. So that's really what I've been playing with a lot. You know, there's other competitors, so I'm just going to go ahead and toss that out there. There's Spectra that also does something similar to what StealthWatch does, and Darktrace, I think, are our lead competitors. So just tossing those out there. The other thing is a lot of people use Splunk for this type of thing. So they get all of the telemetry information and then they have to build queries. If you're familiar with Splunk, you're going to get all this telemetry information and then you're going to build the queries. That's fine. The issue is that you have to know what you're looking for. I'm having fun learning what end hosts are doing. We're no longer in the world that I grew up in, which was secure at the edge and everything's pretty much unencrypted and just put intrusion detection devices there, intrusion prevention devices, figure out what signatures are going on, do whatever, have firewalls. You know, 80% of the traffic now is encrypted. So what kind of things can you do? So that's been really exciting. I've been learning about HTTPS in the sense from the end user device and how some people like financials and whatever are actually doing crypto compliance, crypto audits, for example, with IPv4, making sure that they're not doing RC4 anymore, that they're doing AES, that they're doing more secure stuff with their HTTPS. So that's been very fun. That never occurred to me because it's an end device thing. And crypto mining never really occurred to me. Knowing Tor relays, you know, it's like, oh, you set up a new Tor relay. Well, as soon as you know it, then you know that you're going to it. You know, whether you're encrypted or not, you're going to a Tor relay. So it's been all these really cool aha moments and also learning a lot about how people get into your network and how you look to see and notice that like a port scan is taking place. Somebody's trying to get a foothold in your network. So that to me is kind of sort of what it is. It's like Wireshark to me, but in the sense, because Wireshark, the wire, you know, Wireshark never lies. The wire never lies, right? If it's happening on the wire, it's happening, right? And so from a gathering of telemetry information, basically what you do is you just deputize the network and they all report into what I call the network detective. You know, if it's going through your network, whether it's IPv4 or IPv6, it's your routers and switches and your devices passing it. So all you need to do is kind of sort of tap them on their shoulders and say, yo, do you want to be a confidential informant? Deputize them, get them to report in. You know, let's say that somebody's going to go ahead and they're going to quit Cisco. You know, they just haven't announced it. If they on their NPC are downloading some 5 gig file from like payroll, then that's an inside threat, east, west, not north, south. It's not going to go through a firewall because you think you could trust this person. But it might be suspicious that, you know, they're downloading, you know, some 5 gig file. We don't tend to do that from payroll servers, you know. And so, hey, if it got from point A to point B, it's going through your devices, whether they are Arista, Juniper, Cisco, whatever. They can send IPFix. They can send whatever. You can put a tap on. The tap can convert it to what's called the flow sensor. And then we know what's going on. So what I kiddingly refer to it as is the Network Detective Command Center. And we just go deputize the devices that are passing the traffic. And then they report in. So it's like, you know, they're like the Baker Street Boys for Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah. Those deputized network devices will send flow data to the StealthWatch. And that flow data will contain information about V4 flows and V6 flows.
And V6.
So StealthWatch will take all that V6 flow data and kind of re-put back together what happened. It was Colonel Mustard in the conservatory with the wrench.
Well, absolutely. And that's the difference between the, and I'm assuming that So I'm assuming that the other vendors do similar things. And that's the difference between those types of devices and Splunk, where you have to write the query. You have to know what you're looking for. We're just going to tell you, hey, that's suspicious over there. Hey, that's suspicious too.
Hey, there's a candlestick over here.
Exactly. You know, and it's on the ground and it has blood on it. So, you know, I'm kind of thinking, we might want to tell all the network detectives.
Yes. Yeah. Unlike IPv6, we run out of space for this podcast. Thanks to today's guest, Denise Fishburn, Fish, as we all call her. Denise, how can the audience find you on the internet? What are the things you're writing and sharing? Twitter handles? No need to be shy.
Oh, gosh. Okay. My Twitter is at Denise Fishburn. And people can find me on LinkedIn. Just find me on LinkedIn. I'll accept it because then we can connect. And so I kid that it's really about community and we all learn from each other. And if you're really interested in IPv6, what I would say is if you're new to it, embrace it. I think it's fantastic. It's so much fun. I would say that my favorite blog series is my 7-part blog series for IPv6. And actually, now that I'm done with what I needed to show for StealthWatch, I'm adding IPv6 with that new brand new UCS M5. I am actually now playing in my own little lab environment, and I should have IPv6 StealthWatch blogs and YouTubes up, I would say, by the end of March.
Excellent.
I'm very excited about it. And then try to figure out some IPv6 exploits that are specific to that as well. So that'd be cool.
And definitely look at the Networking with Fish blog. It's just networkingwithfish.com. I love seeing the things you post there. So you can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast hosts, us, Tom Coffeen at IPv6Tom, at E. Horley for Ed, and myself at Scott Hoag. You can also reach us through our at IPv6Buzz Twitter handle. So feel free to reach out to us, ask us questions for future podcasts. So thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz podcast. You can find us on Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. Please check out this episode and any other the great technical content over at Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. Until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.